Welcome to Nonviolent Direct Action, where we examine the societal and personal ramifications of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s insight that to passively accept an unjust system is to cooperate with that system and thereby to become a participant in its evil. You're listening to episode 14 of Nonviolent Direct Action. I'm host Jack Gilroy, and my guest today is nonviolent resistor Ann Tiffany. Later in this episode, we'll conclude the conversation we started in episode 13 with their partner, Ed Canan.
Ann, let's start off like we did with Ed to try to find out, you know, a little bit of your youth, your background, and what sort of led you in this evolution to peace and justice and nonviolent direct action.
Well, I was born in Pennsylvania, and I think I had a really wonderful childhood on a farm. Went to a one-room schoolhouse.
This is where in Pennsylvania?
This was in the Pennsylvania Dutch area.
Oh.
The eastern part of Pennsylvania near Reading, Kutztown, mm-hmm. Pottsville.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that period was a lot of involvement in a Protestant church, a very liberal Protestant church, Presbyterian. And I think as I look back on it, my parents gave me a real sense of the privilege that I have in my life and the responsibility that comes with that privilege. And that was part of the teachings of the church at that time, or the church that I remember. Our minister was wonderful. We would have prayers every morning at home, prayers of gratitude, and I guess that's where I got my sense of privilege. But also with that, a responsibility that comes with having the gifts that we've been given in our lives. And the
when you say gratitude, if you, for listeners and all, what are some of those things that you think of say privilege? And
privilege and gratitude comes that a sense that my life had a serenity, it had a lack of worries about food or shelter, of education, of a home that was stable and caring. And I think I lived among people whose lives were not as smooth as mine seemed to be. I had a wonderful high school experience.
Did you go to a public high school?
Went to a public high school that was mainly Future Farmers of America and Housemakers of America. This was back in the 40s.
Yeah.
And at the same time, my parents helped me be aware that this was not necessarily what the rest of the world enjoys. I think both the church and its missionary work in the teachings of Jesus, knowing that there were suffering in the world. And how that came to me, I'm not sure. But one of my heroes was Albert Schweitzer, who had a hospital in Africa. And one of my goals was to be able to go to Africa and to be a part of the Schweitzer Hospital. So I read.
This is in high school, you're already thinking
this. This is in high school.
Yeah.
And I read about Albert Schweitzer. And so I wanted to become a doctor. But back in the 40s, I was told that that was, guidance teacher in high school said that that wasn't a very good goal for a woman, that I should start thinking about being a nurse, which is exactly what I did.
Yeah.
I really followed some of the cultural norms of that time.
Nurses and teachers, that's what...
Teachers is what women would become.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I went away to college and majored in religion because I still had this sense I wanted to be a medical missionary. But I also, at that time, got a different sense about missionaries. And I started to learn about lots of different religions. And I became disassociated, in a sense, with organized religion. And So by the time I graduated from college and nursing school, I became a Unitarian, and I was a nurse, and I didn't reach the goals that I had for myself. I thought, if I can't get to Africa, I'm going to go to Harlem in New York City, or I was going to do something dramatic. That didn't happen. And I got married and immediately had four children. And this is kind of what women did at that in the 50s.
And that sort of crimped any activism you might have.
It did. I think in college I was fortunate. I worked with the American Friends Service Committee, and there I met a number of conscientious objectors in the work projects. And that was the beginning of my looking beyond my own small world and appreciation. I also became a member of the Fellowship of Reconciliation, although I didn't become really active. But I just felt that I wanted to do something more, something outside of
raising four children, for
raising
example,
four
right?
children.
Yeah.
Although that took all of my energy and I had to work. I was a public health nurse. I was a college health nurse.
Did you work during most of your marriage?
All of my marriage life
you did.
I worked.
Yeah.
And I was a college health nurse during the Vietnam War, so the students would come to the health center and they knew this was one place they could sit down and talk to someone about the Vietnam War. I was very much against it, and I marched against it.
And your children were very young at that time?
My children were very young. They were on my back, and I was pushing two or three of them in a carriage. And this was something that my husband didn't particularly appreciate. He and I had very different political views.
Did you separate? Did you split?
Not until the 70s.
Was it any political motivation that?
There wasn't anything political about that separation. Mm-hmm. I was a member of the Unitarian Church at that time, and the minister there was very politically active, and he, friends that I had in the church, I taught Sunday school. So I was fulfilled in many ways, but my life was somewhat separate from my husband. He was an alcoholic. I was pretty committed to the marriage. I remember talking to my parents about it, and they said, well, no one in our family has ever been divorced, and sent me back to my marriage. I think this is fairly common in that day and age.
Oh, yes, yes. How about your children? Were they a bit upset when you did split?
No, I think they were somewhat relieved. Mm-hmm. There wasn't a lot of tension, but they were aware that neither one of us were particularly happy in our marriage. Mm-hmm. So they were understanding. They were in high school, and I had full custody of my children, and they lived with me.
This is probably skipping ahead of it, but did any of your children ever become active like you have become?
That is skipping ahead.
Yeah.
Because I had two children that went into the military.
Oh, okay.
Very aware that their mother wasn't very happy about that.
Right, right.
Actually surprised about that. But this was in the 70s, and,
sure.
and this one son that went into the Marines said he did it to get away from the environment that he was in at that point, which had drugs and alcohol. He said, I knew I just had to get away. And that was his way of doing it. But anyway, I moved to New Hampshire and began a career in psychiatric nursing. Came back to Syracuse to pursue a master's degree because I thought I really have to better my career. And got involved in the sanctuary movement at the Unitarian Church.
Now, this is in the 80s?
This is in the 80s. Mm-hmm. So my 60s and 80s and 70s were really raising my children.
You're listening to episode 14 of Nonviolent Direct Action. I'm host Jack Gilroy, and my guest today is nonviolent resistor Ann Tiffany. Later in this episode, we'll conclude the conversation we started in episode 13 with her partner, Ed Canan.
Tell us a little bit about that sanctuary movement. You know, Ed touched on it, but you seem to be really deeply involved in that.
I was very deeply involved in that. I became chair of the committee, five Catholic, Jewish, and Christian church, Protestant churches that came together to provide sanctuary for a family. It's a bit different than it was, that word is being used now in the United States. But at this time, it was more of a national organization. There was a lot of support, and the churches, a group in Chicago would interview families that were coming here. Now, the fact is that all Guatemalans and all Salvadorans that entered the U.S. were immediately deported because the U.S. supported the wars, the civil wars that were happening in El Salvador and Guatemala.
And as Ed just mentioned, we were actually training their soldiers in assassination,
absolutely,
and interrogation and torture,
financially supporting country the work of the military and the death squads. So this family arrived in Syracuse. There were seven people, three children, and they just became part of our lives. They were here for 22 months. I went to El Salvador during that time, which was an eye-opener. I also went to Nicaragua during the early part of the sanctuary movement. Both of those experiences allowing me to get out of the U.S. bubble, if you will, and begin to open my eyes to U.S. foreign policy, particularly at that point in Central America. I met Ed at a nonviolence training.
Here in Syracuse,
which was my very first civil disobedience action.
What was that?
We sat in at a senator's office at the federal building against U.S. mining the harbors of Nicaragua and supporting the Contra War against the Sandinistas. And having been in Nicaragua for 2 weeks, with Witness for Peace, I was fully aware of the Sandinista Revolution. I studied the history. I studied U.S. history in Central America and how many times the U.S. has interfered in these countries and has used them for cheap labor and raw materials. So I was very much against U.S. policy in Central America at that point, and continue to feel that way. But so we sat in at the senator's office, and I was with Eddie. We were in the same affinity group, and we became friends. And it was a very important friendship for me. And gradually, we entered a relationship.
It became romantic after a period of time.
We became romantic after about 6 months, yes.
Looks like it worked pretty well because
you're
talking about 1983.
Well.
Yeah,
it did. My friends always joked about it because I'm a bit older than Ed, and I was convinced that, I guess because of my past experience, it was important that I was with someone who had the same political views that I had and also was able to be outside of my middle class culture. I really wanted to break out a bit. And this was pretty hard on my four children. And so my relationship with my four children is really important to me, obviously. And so we went through a period of trying to work that out, and I think we've worked it out fairly well.
You visit them?
I am very close to all four of my children.
That's yes. Nice, yeah. Where are they? In the USA?
In the USA, my son and daughter are here in Syracuse area. They live in the country. I have 10 grandchildren and 6 great-grandchildren. I have a son in Virginia and a son in Connecticut.
Nice.
So, but through the sanctuary movement, I think that was a major period in my life. We talked about like having starter things. You have people come from El Salvador, and it's just the beginning of looking at the much broader picture of U.S. policy and foreign policy and how decisions are made. And so That led to the School of the Americas.
Did you go down to the School of the Americas with Ed from the beginning?
Yes. The first thing we did was the 40-day fast. In 1993, Father Roy Bourgeois called for a 40-day fast in Washington, D.C., on the steps of the Capitol. And supporters came from all over the country to participate in that fast. We met lots of people at the steps of the Capitol, and that became our major activity here in Syracuse. In upstate New York, as you probably know, I think there were at least 15 people that have done prison time. So we had a large organization right here in Syracuse.
And you say sitting on the Capitol steps, which I guess you couldn't do today.
You couldn't do it today,
but
no.
You did. Tell us a little bit about that fast itself.
That fast was a wonderful experience. We stayed at a Catholic worker house, just met really interesting people constantly. It was a juice fast, and so churches throughout the D.C. area would provide us with wonderful different kinds of organic juices. I don't think any of us suffered from the fast.
Did you ever meet any political individuals?
Certainly did. Mm-hmm. We met our own representative. They would come out to the steps to talk to us. I think it made a difference. And Joe Kennedy, I think, was the major sponsor of a bill to close the School of the Americas. So he spent time with us.
That was in Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
But then before long, you're on your way to Fort Benning, Georgia, the home of the School of the Americas, or
right.
you people call it the School of Assassins,
School
SOA.
Of Assassins, right. And we did, there were about 300 of us arrested prior to our spending time in prison. But there was this constant effort of trying to get more people, just like we do now, educating people, getting them more aware. Ed and I spent a tremendous amount of time writing a booklet called The Gandhian Wave, trying to encourage people to come to Fort Benning, not just in November, but throughout the rest of the year. Father Bill Bixel was part of that. Ed's action in September prior to the November action was part of that. I spent time there with students from Oberlin College who did do an action there that was really well publicized.
Were you ever arrested there?
I was arrested there twice. Spent 6 months in Danbury Prison.
Could you tell us a little bit about that?
I think I was very much prepared for that. I'm a psychiatric nurse with a master's in counseling. So to go into a woman's prison and meet the women there and feel a part of their lives felt really comfortable to me. It was a sad experience. I made a lot of good connections.
You never made it to Africa to be a missionary, but all of a
there
sudden
there.
There
I was in prison.
Yeah.
And there was another thing I want to speak to about doing civil disobedience, because it's a major part. And it mainly came to me my first arrest at Hancock Air Base, which felt much more independent. But a sense of when the handcuffs were put on me by the police in my own hometown, a sense of freedom, a sense of I finally come into my own individual sense of who I was, my identity that I had really worked for a long time to struggle to be released from other people's expectations of me. I guess that's it, the culture, to break loose and say, this is who I am, and I can stand here and be free to be who I am.
You're listening to episode 14 of Nonviolent Direct Action. I'm host Jack Gilroy, and my guest today is nonviolent resistor Ann Tiffany. Later in this episode, we'll conclude the conversation we started in episode 13 with her partner, Ed Canan.
You moved on from there, as Ed did as well. You two worked together when you began to discover the terrorism that was emanating from the 174th attack wing here in Syracuse, New York. Could you sort of relate some of that?
Well, yeah, I can relate some of that. And I think what led to that, we both spent time in Palestine, in the West Bank, and to see U.S. policy in that area. So, I mean, we continued to educate ourselves, but it was wonderful in a way to bring it home and know that it was being acted on right here in Syracuse, New York, at the National Guard base and the federal military program there with the drones. So from the very beginning, we knew that civil resistance, putting our bodies against this horror, that was the way we had to address the issue. So we did a lot of research, and one of the best parts about our actions was that we were able to bring people from Albany and Utica and Rochester and Buffalo, so throughout upstate New York. So it became upstate drone action. And we had wonderful people like Kathy Kelly and Ann and Cornell West came to speak here, all of them on this subject, so that it grew larger numbers of people. And Dan Bergevin, our artist friend, who's been very supportive of our work, provided the visuals for our actions. So we started out and we did a couple of die-ins at the base, trying to say, this is what the drones do in other countries, and they shoot out these missiles and they decimate villages and communities. But then we started talking about what we called the big books, the Constitution.
Tell us about the big books. What was that
action? Well, Dan Bergevin made these huge 8-foot books that address the treaties that the U.S. signed, that talked about, like, the Constitution, and I'm trying to think, the law schools at New York University and Stanford did a whole book on the drone activities in Pakistan, so we made a big book of that.
Now, did these books, were they taken away by the...
They took all of our objects away, yes.
It would be sort of interesting to imagine them taking those books in as evidence to the courtroom.
To the courtroom. Unfortunately, they never brought anything to the courtroom. But the last action there, that there were, I think, 9 or 10 of us arrested.
You were arrested. You
said arrested. Yes.
At the base.
The base a couple times. Mm-hmm. Not as frequently as Ed has been. Mm-hmm. My role has frequently been just logistics, hospitality, trying to figure out where the arrestees go, providing transportation, encouraging people to support. The action that I appreciated was pointing out the amount of money that goes into our military actions, and including the drones. Lockheed Martin, all the big General Dynamics that support the drone program. We had huge dollar signs and names of all the huge corporations, that we have become convinced that the military-industrial complex is very important and it keeps our economy going. And I think that our media does a good job of letting people know that they keep us secure, which I also think is one reason that the drone program is so successful. We're very appreciative, as when we hold our signs, people will say, well, you can do that and you can express what you believe because you have the U.S. military protecting you. They give us that right to do that. And I think people think that we need to have security here, that our 800 military bases in the world provide for us. I personally think it's quite the opposite. It makes us less secure, more insecure.
And you decided on nursing over education and teaching, but you've been educating people for decades. Do you think that there's anything more that maybe school teachers who might be listening to this broadcast could do to try to get the children to develop greater compassion and empathy for people in countries around the world, many of those countries that we actually attack and kill their families?
Well, I hate to be pessimistic, because I don't think, one, that our schools do a good job of teaching critical thinking, of teaching people to ask questions, that I think is essential, to not simply accept what they're told. But beyond that, I think we need to stop teaching the myths of our own country. There's this big effort here in Syracuse to change the name of Columbus Day to Indigenous Peoples Day. But the history of our country is taught by the history of the wars that we have successfully won. Mm-hmm. That I guess I think the teachers need education. And out of that comes better history books and awareness. Now, it's also happening because I think our schools are becoming more diverse. Up until 2016, when Mr. Trump became president, refugees are now, you know, we had a lot more refugees and a lot more refugees here in Syracuse. So they're in the school, in the classrooms, and I think that helps. Ed and I spoke at several high schools here in Syracuse. And the one that I think we may have made a difference in, we were asked to not come back because I guess we were a little too liberal, a little too outspoken, a little too critical of our country's policies.
Because the teachers themselves and the administrators, they've already drunk the Kool-Aid, you're saying, right? That they're part of the system.
I think it's hard. But there are programs out there. There are Iraq Veterans Against the War that are speaking in high schools, and I think the more that can happen, the better.
Well, if I was superintendent of schools of Syracuse, I would have you two in every day, elementary school, middle school, high school, because they need to listen to your story. So thanks very much, Anne, for sharing just a little bit of an amazing history, and especially your influence in direct nonviolent action.
Well, it's been very important to me, Jack. That's been a major change in my life.
You're listening to episode 14 of Nonviolent Direct Action. My guest has been longtime nonviolent civil resistor, Anne Tiffany. Next, we'll conclude the conversation we started in episode 13 with Anne's partner, Ed Canaan.
So, Ed, you know, one of the items that I didn't bring up before, Anne spoke when we had our conversation, was your time in Iraq in 2003, March of 2003, when shock and awe, the attack on the people of Iraq, and especially Baghdad. You were there. Could you kind of tell us how, what, when, where, and why of that whole thing?
My mother had just died on Christmas Day, 2002. And Anne and I had been kind of caring for her in her last months. And so I was very free then. And so we had close friends who kind of worked with Kathy Kelly of Voices in the Wilderness. And he had been over in Iraq. And I think he was trying to recruit me to go. And I was very glad to do that when my mom died and I was free. So in February of 2003, I went to Iraq to join the Iraq peace team of Voices in the Wilderness, which was sort of coordinated by Kathy Kelly. So I was there from, I think, around February 7th or 8th until early April. And of course, that was the time, so it was before the invasion, the U.S. invasion of Iraq, during the 3 weeks or so of shock and awe, and then after shock and awe subsided and the U.S. military was occupying Iraq. So I had those three moments, if you will, of the U.S.-Iraq interface invasion.
If people are listening to this 10 years from now or maybe even next month, shock and awe should probably be explained.
Shock and awe was this military doctrine, foreign policy doctrine of the U.S., whereby they didn't use the word, they would so terrorize a population through bombardment, through missiles, through bombs, through destruction of infrastructure, attacking civilian centers. Baghdad, the capital of Iraq, enormous destruction. Anyway, the Iraq peace team went there, I think sometime late in 2002, to accompany the Iraq people to better understand where they were coming from in their situation, and also the thought being to be there in case the U.S. did invade, to do protective accompaniment, hoping that our presence would deter some of the violence. So I was a part of that. There were, I would say, 30 or so of us from various countries, mostly the U.S., Britain. Our friend Neville from Australia was there. He was a minister, and I think his father had been a parliamentarian in Australia. We had several South Koreans were with us. And we mostly were in a little family hotel where we lodged called the El Fanar, which was like 100 yards from the Tigris River. I was in a room that overlooked the Tigris River. The El Fanar was just across the street from the Palestine Hotel, which is a big kind of formerly probably a five-star hotel, but it was where all the world media that came to Iraq were housed. They were all together in that one hotel. And our job was kind of to report on conditions there. And so we went to hospitals, we went to markets. Once the bombardment began,
This is during or before shock and awe?
Well, the bombardment was the beginning of shock and awe.
But you were visiting some of these institutions
beforehand,
right?
Yeah, and then when shock and awe began, the bombardment began, we would visit, you know, neighborhoods that had been bombed.
Was this the bombing take place at night mostly or daytime?
I don't have a clear sense of the numbers or the proportions of that, but it was around the clock, you know, sporadically and unpredictably.
You could hear and see and
I could see the fire. I mean, it was like fireworks, like July 4th, which is kind of an irony, July 4th. A lot of it was, I could see across the Tigris to this neighborhood where Saddam Hussein, the president, the strong man, had one of his palaces. So, of course, that was hit very heavily, you know, hoping to decapitate the country. It was very dramatic. We taped our windows, you know, like our rooms, because of shattering glass is where a lot of casualties come from in bombardments. So we all had whistles around our neck with the expectation that we would probably be under rubble at some point, and our voices might be incapacitated, but at least we could blow the whistle to alert rescue teams. And there was other such precautions that we took, including we bought up a lot of bottled water. We had like this huge closet of just bottled water, not knowing what would happen to the water supply during the attack. And there was provision for going down in the basement as sort of a bomb shelter. And besides us, there were these families of the relatives of the owner who stayed in the hotel. And I was very impressed with them. They were used to being bombarded over the years by the U.S. I mean, it wasn't as intense as shock and awe, but they just would so matter-of-factly and calmly just file their way down into
during
the
sanctions period preceding.
Yeah. 90 or 91. And they had such dignity, such lack of panic. They're very impressive people, I thought, Iraqis. Anyway, and you know, occasionally I'd be diving to the floor. I mean, that was not unusual. And one of the other people in our group was Cynthia Bannis from upstate New York, a woman in her 80s who was deathly startled by the bombing when what happened. And yet she stayed with it. I mean, there was no question about her wanting to be there with the Iraqi people and be in resistance to the U.S.
You're listening to Nonviolent Direct Action. I'm host Jack Gilroy, and my guest is longtime nonviolent civil resistor Ed Canaan.
Kathy Kelly wrote, I think, in a magazine, I think it was the Progressive, about Cynthia going out to greet the invading Americans. You saw that, I'm sure.
Oh, I was part of it. I was with her.
You're with her. Okay, yeah. Well, that's all the better.
That's going to take maybe a few minutes to tell that story. So try not to get me off on something else, and I'll try to be concise. Around April 8th, I mentioned the Palestine Hotel across the street. The Marines were on the outskirts of Baghdad, and they bombarded the Palestine. Well, from where they were bombarding, our hotel, Elf and I, was just right under the path. We didn't get hit, but when the Palestine was hit, a couple of journalists were killed. I didn't know them personally, but our team knew these guys. And then right across the river, the Tigris, was the building of Al Jazeera, and it was hit. Al Jazeera is a broadcast network based in the Middle East that presented, maybe for the first time, an Arabic perspective on the world, but it had very global perspectives. So it was a very effective counterpoint to U.S. mainstream media.
So they took out Al Jazeera.
Well, the building is more or less intact, but it did get bombed, and one of the journalists who was up on the roof broadcasting was killed. And then there was another Islamic, or I don't know if it's Islamic or just Arabic, broadcasting, you know, worldwide broadcasting network that was also that same day. When they wanted to destroy reports about shock and awe from the international media, and they also wanted to drive media out of Iraq. And that was quite a scramble because the employers of the reporters that were there basically told almost all of them, you've got to leave. And to leave meant going 12 hours through the desert in taxis, private taxis, which by that time cost a mint to get rides. So it was a lot of scrambling around to get rides. And that had happened before, somewhat before, or during shock and awe. This was this out-migration of the world's media. We stayed. That was our mission, was to stay during the whole duration of it. So anyway, the day that the U.S. Marines came into Baghdad, they surrounded the two hotels with machine gun placements and tanks. Now, I don't think our hotel or our presence was necessarily all that important. It was definitely a move to intimidate the world's media. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we had already on the side facing the Palestine hotel and the side facing the south where the troops would be coming in, these very large photos that we hung on the outside of the hotel of, so to speak, typical Iraqis, just human beings that we wanted the media to see, but also the military to see. So we had a number of those big photos. And also, when the Marines arrived, Neville, this member of our team who was from Australia, from Perth, who was a prominent figure, he was an attorney, he was a minister, he went on the balcony facing south with a sign. I'm not sure what it said precisely, I don't recall, but we had already put this banner, maybe it was a 20-foot long banner, across that side of the hotel that said, courage for peace, not for war. Now, when the tanks got into place around us, Cynthia said, you know, we've got all this water. These poor guys are probably short of water.
Cynthia Bannis, the 80-year-old.
Cynthia Bannis, yes, who lives not too far from here in central New York. So she was going to go down and offer them water. Now, I felt pretty ambivalent about that. I didn't want to be seen by Iraqis as sort of collaborating with the invader, but also, I mean, maybe I was a little protective of Cynthia, but also, as I mentioned earlier, I'm kind of a secular guy, but I do like this notion of seeking the divine within everybody, or seeking the God within everybody. It's part of a nonviolent ethic that I absorbed some
the Quakers
from.
As well.
Quakers, yeah. I mean, so I went down with her, and there were, I think, a couple of other folks with us too, several of us. And Cynthia approached the tank, the one that was right kind of near our exit of the hotel, offering water. And she immediately engaged in a conversation with the tank guys. I was kind of standing back, kind of. I didn't want to say anything to them. I didn't feel I could speak to them. So I didn't say anything at that point. Then there were these two or three South Koreans who had brought with them a huge vinyl mural that they rolled up and they brought to Iraq. And they put it in sort of the intersection. And the mural showed like children. And then there was like some kind of bombardment imagery. They unrolled it amongst these tanks. And what we did was, the team members, we kind of took shifts of just going out and sitting by the vinyl quietly, the mural. And then if soldiers approached us, maybe engage in conversation with them. So at that point, I felt I could talk to the soldiers, and we did. But even before that, Kathy Kelly, Voices of the Wilderness, came down out of the hotel with a plate of dates, which is, in the Islamic world, the Arabic world, is a way of welcoming people. And she went from tank to tank offering dates to them. And again, I felt ambivalent about any sort of symbolism of welcoming, but I think where she was coming from was this idea of the God within everyone.
Right.
And in the Middle East, and I've lived in different Middle Eastern countries, traveled in them, this idea of welcoming is so important. Hospitality is just so important, deep into the culture.
And Kathy had lived in Iraq on and off during the sanctions,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So she pretty well knew the Arabic sense of welcome.
Sure, yeah. And she told us about this later. In her circuit around to the various things, she encountered the tank commander. And he told her, you know, these boys, meaning the other soldiers, they're probably as bewildered about this as a lot of people. They did not enlist in order to be in a war. They probably wanted tuition for college or something, and here they are in this situation. And I'm just losing sleep at night about what's happening to these guys. For me, it was just a very kind of poignant kind of experience to be there when the Marines came into Baghdad.
You're listening to Nonviolent Direct Action. I'm host Jack Gilroy, and my guest is longtime nonviolent civil resistor, Ed Canaan.
So, Ed, when did you leave? The bombing, pretty much the intensive bombing stopped, and you stayed on for a while.
A few days.
Tell us about that. Yeah.
The Saddam Hussein regime, which, although he had gone underground, but made it clear somehow. We had handlers, you know, that were part of Iraqi intelligence, security, that we interacted with a lot while we were there. And they said the Iraqi government can't keep track of all of you. I mean, we were out and about on the streets at times and stuff, so we were kind of loose cannons in our own way. So some of you have to leave. Now, it's hard to leave just logistically, because to go from Baghdad to Amman, like I mentioned, it's a 12-hour trip, you know, through the desert. Paved road. So, you know, we had this big gathering among the volunteers of who would leave. People did not want to leave. You know, our team wanted to stay. And Kathy had to tell people, certain people, they had to leave. It's a very hard decision for her. I mean, she was anguished to be hierarchical, because she's not a hierarchical person.
Right.
And to sort of say, hey, you guys got to leave. Just certain numbers of them. And I was among a handful that was able to stay for a while. And then, I don't know what it was, a week into the occupation, then I was told I had to leave, which I did.
Time to come back.
Yeah.
Now, how does that experience tie in with Palestine, both you and Anne? Anne was not with you in Baghdad during the shock and awe,
right.
But you were together when you went to Palestine. Could you just kind of fit that timeline in?
Okay. Actually, we weren't together. I'm not sure why we weren't, but it had to do with, we each went with different Christian peacemaker teams, delegations. And Christian peacemaker teams was also kind of an international accompaniment project that had a base in the West Bank. So we were on separate delegations. So we went separately, but it was around the same season, you know, within a couple of months of one another, something like that.
What year was this, the Palestine?
I'm not sure.
Years are meshed in.
But 2008, 2007.
Well, we're trying to establish, you know, a little bit of chronology, and this is 2003 that you spent such an interesting time in Baghdad. But then when you and Anne went to Palestine, this is a few years later.
Yeah, several, yeah.
Yeah, and why did you go there, and what did you do when you did go there?
Well, let me backtrack a little. So after I came home in 2003, April 2003, then several months later, I went back to Baghdad with the Voices in the Wilderness and was there from late August to early November. But our visas had run out, the U.S. was in charge, and actually it was getting very dicey for us to remain in Iraq. A lot of people were being kidnapped, so when our visa ran out, it was time for us to leave. Though, again, we wanted to stay. Anyway, so you ask about Palestine.
About Palestine, right.
Okay. I had been sort of an Israeli hawk when I was in my 20s. I was so proud of Israelis for standing up to the whole Arab world attacking them. But in the meantime, I had read a book. I'd done some reading on the situation and came to see Israel as a colonial settler state. So I wanted to go and raise my own consciousness. I wanted to be in a position to be able to come back to the States and speak with authority, because that happened after Iraq. I was on a couple of nationwide tours speaking about the occupation. So I envisioned, you know, coming back to the States and also doing some speaking and writing. So that's why I went to Palestine. Also, there's the role of the very important role sometimes of internationalists coming to a hotspot, and that leading to some diminution in the tension, in the violence, just because there's international eyes on the situation. So that was another motivation for going to Palestine. The delegation with Christian peacemaker teams was, I don't know, 10 or 11 days, something like that. We spent a few days in Israel and then, say, a week in the West Bank. Then after that, I didn't want to go home right away, so I spent, like, the next couple of weeks in Israel. I thought it was important to get a sense for what Israel was like, and what, you know, the people there feel about things. So I did that. I spent a week or so in a kibbutz, but also traveling around to, you know, visiting the parliament, visiting the famous museum there, the Holocaust, and just meeting with different civil society people.
So with those two societies, those two cultures, that historical connection between the two people, what was your takeaway from that? How would you summarize your views, your attitudes, your feelings, your intellectual curiosity about your experience?
Well, I came to understand that the situation of the Palestinian people was very much like the situation of Native Americans here in the U.S., 19th century and before. Native Americans kept getting crammed into smaller and smaller spaces amidst enormous oppression and massacres, quite parallel with the Palestinians. It was really since the 1940s, when the Zionists came to power in Israel, it was ethnic cleansing, and it's been ethnic cleansing ever since. Not only the violence that's going on currently with the snipers at the Gaza border, which is another part of Palestine, but just the whole legal system the whole apartheid system of Israel, so focused on trying to drive the Palestinians off the territory they have, you know, Gaza and the West Bank. The parallel between what the European settler colonialists did in what's called U.S., and that what the Israelis, mostly Europeans, did to the indigenous people of Palestine. I mean, it's a very close parallel in terms of the oppression, the violence, the theft of land, and the destruction of culture. Except that the Palestinians are resisting by just staying there, which many of them have.
I'm sure you met many Jews who were opposed to what their government was up to. And in the United States, it seems there's a very large population of Jewish Americans who are just embarrassed, unhappy with it. But it seems to be that almost any criticism today of Israel, the attitude, the comment is, you're anti-Semitic. Mm-hmm. What's your take on that?
Well, I think it's a very real, and it does kind of quash activism against Israel's military. I think it's very real that that's happening. I've experienced myself, when I came back from South Africa in the early 80s, and then started learning about the situation in Palestine, I wrote an article in a local kind of progressive journal. I mean, I wrote a lot about South African apartheid, and then I wrote another article about Israeli apartheid. And that was back before ex-President Carter wrote his book about Israel and Palestine. It was kind of, it wasn't a very common understanding. And so in the next month in the journal, you know, there was an article rebutting me by members of, you know, so-called progressive group locally, you know, referring to my anti-Semitism. Yeah. So I'm used to that, yeah, that slander, that way of mystifying the situation in Israel, which most liberals buy into, or certainly were in that era. Now, one of the positive things here is that according to a certain poll, certain polls, young U.S. Jewish people are much less buying into the idea of Israeli legitimacy.
And yet, you know, people like Noam Chomsky, who was raised as a Jewish person. Noam Chomsky is one of the great political intellectuals of our time.
And other times.
And, yeah, and other times as well. And yet, Noam Chomsky is almost a pariah to the national networks. You don't see Noam Chomsky on the evening news, you know, on even the Public Broadcasting Corporation, for example. So why is that? Why is individuals such as Phil Donahue, for example, who you don't hear about him anymore, Colin McCarthy was eventually released from the Washington Post, people who were very critical. What's your feeling about that?
Well, U.S. mainstream media basically gets its cues from the government, the U.S. government. You cited some media. The New York Times never, I think, never printed a op-ed from Noam Chomsky, who is one of the most prolific writers, mm-hmm, and analysts in the world.
Right.
But they boycott him. He's a truth teller. He exposes U.S. imperialism, U.S. hegemony, and he wrote a book called The Fateful Triangle, which I read years ago, which documented so well the Israeli ethnic cleansing of Palestine. Just the first paragraph of the book pointed out the extreme disparity among the casualties, Israeli casualties and Palestinian casualties. Of course, on the Palestinian side, they're called terrorists.
Right.
Well, in fact, it's the IDF, the Israeli Defense Force, that are the terrorists. I mean, terrorism is mostly state terrorism, and it's mostly perpetrated by people in uniform or their officers.
What's your next visit overseas, Ed? Are you going to be going to Afghanistan to see if any of those missiles that you are opposed to, the hellfires that are fired really from not too far from where we are right now? Did you ever give any thought to that?
Yeah, I gave quite a bit of thought to that. In fact, I spent a month in Afghanistan a few years ago, a main purpose being to see what I could learn about the effect of drones on the people there. And what I learned, or what I didn't learn, was the effect of the drones on the people there, because our delegation, which again was with the successor of Voices in the Wilderness called Voices
for Creative Nonviolence.
Creative Nonviolence, yeah. We barely could even get out of Kabul, the capital, because the security situation was so tough. I mean, you know, the Taliban kind of controlled the countryside, and the U.S. forces were pretty much holed up in Kabul, the capital. So we didn't get out to talk to people out in the field that were surviving the drone attacks. A lot of our talk was with representatives of various sectors in Kabul, and actually, they had a pretty cushy life with this invasion. You know, even if they were in NGOs often, non-government organizations, hell, they had a job, you know. And compared to what the jobs were available to the population at large, pretty nice jobs, you know, with international agencies.
Well, we know that there's much more that you could add to this conversation, but we really appreciate it, both you and Anne, to be able to tell us so much about your early life and the evolution that led you to the situation now where you've survived prison, jail, and a lot of harassment from the media, and probably a lot of harassment from even neighbors who can't understand why you do the things you do. But for our particular group, we have to say thank you very much.
Shukran to you. That's Arabic for thank you.
You've been listening to episode 14 of Nonviolent Direct Action. I'm host Jack Gilroy, and my guests have been longtime nonviolent resistors Ed Canaan and Ann Tiffany. You can find this episode and the entire Nonviolent Direct Action series on iTunes. You can find related links on our blog, nonviolentdirectaction.blogspot.com. Thanks for listening.